Thank you all. We're here for our last and certainly not least session of the program today, which is part of our Article 1 presentation. Our speaker, and I don't think he needs much introduction with you, but I want to point out a couple things. He has served in Article 1, right, as a House member, and is now the director of the Office of Management and Budget, so a key senior presidential advisor to President Trump, having to deal with his former colleagues on questions of spending. In fact, he reminded me that it's budget week and they're about to release the budget. So thank you for coming in the middle of that. I know... The Club for Growth, one of my other hats, we were an early supporter of Mick Mulvaney when he ran in 2010. Won a seat in South Carolina that had not been represented by a Republican, I think, since the Civil War. So he is a political change agent. He is also, as the man who now directs OIRA, going to be on the point in dealing with the regulatory agencies for the president, a key role that can assist in getting some of the things that we've debated today back into the right framework in the Constitution. He came north for undergraduate at Georgetown and then went back down south to UNC for his law degree. But he's also an entrepreneur. I want to find out what type of family restaurant he has for one of my road trips to visit relatives in South Carolina. But without further ado, I think you'll find Mick Mulvaney is one of the most intelligent and insightful political leaders that we have on today's scene, and it is truly a delight to have you here, Mick.
my friend Reed Ribble from Wisconsin once introduced me as one of the smartest members of Congress, and the next person got up, I think it was Trey Gowdy, and said that's like being the tallest midget. Thank you all very much for having me. I'm not going to talk very long. For those of you who see me speak before, I don't do speeches very well. In fact, I don't do them at all. I got handed this as I walked through the door. At least this time I remember my glasses. And one of the reasons I learned a very valuable lesson. Back when I was still an elected official down in South Carolina, I was in the state legislature, and we went to some thing that you do. In the middle of July, I was at a cancer center opening. And I was the ninth of nine elected officials to speak at the outdoor tent in Lancaster County, South Carolina in July. And then behind me was the air conditioning and the drinks. And I was last, and they said, blah, 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 here's State Rep. Mulvaney. I got up and I said, thanks very much, and I sat down. And this little old lady walked up to me in the air conditioning afterwards. She said, son, that was the best political speech I've ever heard. So lesson learned. They asked me to talk a little bit about the interaction between the legislative branch and the executive branch, something I'm getting a little bit more familiar with now that I'm in the executive branch. And what I thought I'd do is just tell a little bit about the dynamic as it exists today, and not necessarily get into, we're going to take questions and answers here at the end, and we get more specifically into maybe the role of OIRA at OMB, the role of the delegation of authority, that type of thing. But I want to sort of try and at least lay a little bit of background as to what the relationship is like right now. And what I want to do is use the recent experience with the healthcare bill that just passed out of the House as sort of a way to tell the tale and add some texture so that you sort of get a feel for what things are like up here. Because, as is so often the case, the media is not entirely accurate on that. And that's fine. I've often told the folks who cover me, as long as you get the ideas right, we're okay with that. We give up a long time ago on getting it verbatim right. But as long as I say A and you said that I said A, that's okay. If I said A and you said that I say B, that's a real problem. But let's go back and go through the process. So here we are, with the House has a health care bill, and we're spending a lot of time up on the Hill, myself, Mike Pence. The president was having folks come down. This is when we introduced the president to the concept of the Freedom Caucus, which was an interesting conversation for me to have, as we're going down how they vote and how they have to have an 80% threshold and how they like to vote as a group and they act as a team. And I'm in the Oval Office with a group of people and he goes, what is this Freedom Caucus? Who's responsible for this? And I'm like, I am. So keeping in mind, though, that the group was actually the working title of the group was never the Freedom Caucus. The working title when we founded it, as myself and eight other members of Congress, was the Reasonable Nutjob Caucus. And the The goal was, there's plenty of folks who vote no all the time in Congress, and there are plenty of folks who vote yes all the time, and we were looking for folks who are able to do both in really, really tough spots. And the goal was supposed to be that we would move the ball in the conservative direction a little bit. So we would fight, and then at the very end, we'd come in and deliver the votes necessary as long as we thought the bill had moved a little bit in our direction. And I remember laying that out for the president, and then it didn't happen. In fact, I was looking really, really brilliant until the day that the first vote didn't take place. Remember that we said we're going to have a vote today? That was actually my message to we want to vote tomorrow. The night before, we went down there on a Friday afternoon, we're expecting a vote, and they call off the vote. And that's when I started looking like a real idiot. Because I told the president, look, they're going to push, and then come at the end. And I learned a couple things. First of all, the Freedom Caucus was far from the problem in that scenario. Fully half the members of the Freedom Caucus had whipped yes on the bill. So that was one of the things I think the media got wrong. We had our own whip counts. I know the whip count pretty solidly within the Freedom Caucus. There's roughly at any given time about 36 members, and we had almost 18 yeses, maybe 17 yeses out of the group. So it was not the Freedom Caucus versus the world, as was, I think, sort of laid bare in the later discussions. There were groups on both ends of the Republican spectrum who had difficulties with the bill, and that was the case on that first Friday. We had some hardcore right-wing conservatives against it and some of our more moderate centrists against it, and that was the dynamic. But the one thing that I really learned through that first couple of weeks, in fact, through this whole process, was that the House really had a lot of division in it that I wasn't aware of. I was, as a founding member of the Freedom Caucus, I have been friends with a lot of folks in leadership. Paul Ryan had asked me, because he thought that I was one of the nut jobs you could work with, to come and sit on this weekly meeting that he had with what we call the cross-sectional group. So I had developed a relationship with Paul and other members of leadership, and I had developed a relationship, in fact, personally, with very many moderate members, whether it be through playing baseball, working out in the gym in the morning. And I thought everybody felt that way. And what I didn't realize until that day of that vote was that the House had some divisions that were internal and they were real and they were much more significant than anybody realized. And they had absolutely nothing to do with the bill and even less to do with the President of the United States. People asked me, they said, did the president fail to deliver? I said, no, because the House has problems that the president can't fix. And that's when we decided that it was time for us to sort of step back. And I remember us talking about, we need them to go home for 2 weeks and calm down and work on healing their own divisions, because that was the only way they were ever going to be able to get together to vote on anything. Again, I think they've made some improvements to the bill at the last couple of days, but generally speaking, the changes were not that dramatic. What they need to figure out was how they were going to function as a Republican majority, and they needed to figure it out amongst themselves. Thankfully, that happened, and thankfully, I think they're now in a much, much better place, and we're looking forward to working with them now as a functioning majority. It'll be, I think it was an interesting test. The next bill that came out after that was the funding bill, which we can talk about during Q&A if you want to. But there was much less rancor, much less yelling and screaming, much less worrying about who got credit for the win. In fact, that's when I knew we were in trouble on that first pass at the health care bill, was when in meetings someone would say, well, I can't vote for that because they're going to get credit for the victory. Or we're going to stop this so that that person gets blamed. Again, nothing, if any, or very little to do, if anything, with the actual substance of the bill, and absolutely nothing to do with who the president is, and everything to do with the divisions in the House. So as we sit here today and we talk about the interaction between the legislative branch and the executive branch, I think everybody assumes that they function the way that the founding fathers intend them to function. And I have news for you, they probably do, to be honest with you. But they don't function the way they used to think on TV, with the Schoolhouse Rock, I'm just a bill, yes, I'm only a bill, and the House gets together and does this, and everybody's happy, and the Senate does something different, and they go to conference. This is an institution made up of 535 human beings, and it is subject to the same whims and difficulties that any other organization that's made up of those types of, that number of people is. So when we sit here and we talk about the interaction at the Federalist Society, we drill down, and I've never been a member, but I've spoken to this group for about 15 years, even before I was in politics. Anybody from Charlotte, North Carolina here? No? There used to be an active group in Charlotte. Is that we look at the piece of paper and say, okay, the Congress is supposed to function like this, and then the executive branch is supposed to function like this, when really what we talk about is that's probably a guide as much as anything else, and the real world can be very, very different. And the Congress will function differently today than it did 20 years ago and differently than it will 10 years from now. But the beauty of the document is that it provides for all of those various different contingencies, and the government can still function. And against that backdrop, you have the executive, which is clearly different from administration to administration. And you have this almost infinite number of combinations between the types of Congress that you could have at any one time and the types of administration that you could have at one time. And I think we've all seen the differences in outcomes that that has led to in terms of the Obama administration versus a perhaps slightly dysfunctional House. What did that mean? That gave the Obama administration free rein to pretty much do whatever they want, free of many of the checks and balances, or at least free of many of the real checks and balances. You fast forward now to a Republican administration is a little bit more respectful of the divisions between the two branches, and you're not seeing nearly as much of that executive overreach, even though you've got a Congress that is almost as dysfunctional as it was a year ago. So, and then as we look forward, we've got a situation that maybe, because you have a president who's not pushing too hard on the envelope, it does give Congress the time to heal itself. So maybe that's my way of wrapping up with this part and saying, I'm fairly optimistic. I'm fairly optimistic with what we're going to be able to do versus through the next 2 years, 4 years, 8 years, in terms of getting the two branches to work together. Because I think we've got folks who, at the end of the day, despite the internal difficulties that the House might be having at any particular time, the internal challenges that any White House will have at any particular time, you've got a bunch of folks who, at the end of the day, are all trying to pull in the same direction. And I think that is something to be proud of and to look forward to. So with that, I'll let David ask some questions. You folks want to ask questions, and we can talk about just about anything except the budget, which comes out on Tuesday, because it's not for public consumption yet, despite the leaks that had come out.
Nick, maybe you could start with a few comments on your vision for the role that OIRA will play.
Yes, for those of you who don't know OMB, and most of you shouldn't, because you're just not that geeky and down in the weeds, there's a saying about my agency, which is that if you live outside the Beltway, you've never heard of it, and if you live inside the Beltway, you don't know what it is. We are sort of the central junction box for government. Just about everything at some point flows in some fashion through OMB. And in the regulatory world, that means that every single executive order that might come out of the West Wing of the White House comes to OIRA for us to sort of scrub it before it goes out to see the world. And every single agency that's sitting there very diligently in their cubicles making regulations before those will go out to get to see the world come back through OMB again. So everything sort of flows through us, and it does give us a chance to sort of put the president's very unique and distinct thumbprint on what regulations are going to look like. And say what you want to about Donald Trump, and I know the media recently has been saying a lot of things. You've never heard anybody say that he is not absolutely committed to regulatory reform. Go back and read, thank you. Go back and read his first book. I mean, go back and read The Art of the Deal. I think there's two or three chapters on government inefficiencies and what government regulations do to businesses and how awful it is. He comes by this naturally. This is not something he just adopted for purposes of running a campaign. He really believes that. And I know he's not been very active, but when he named Carl Icahn to sort of this special advisor on regulatory policy, I was really excited about that because what that told me, I was waiting to be confirmed at the time, was that the president was deadly serious about this, because Carl is not only a great businessman, he's also one of the president's best friends. And you're not going to ask somebody with that type of stature to get involved in your administration if they're not actually going to have a commitment to it. So when I heard that, I'm like, wow, this is going to be absolutely fabulous. So when I got confirmed, we sat down and started talking about what OIRA could do. And that's when the transition team and the OMB team came up with this two-for-one idea. Which is that, with some exceptions, important exceptions that I think folks in this room would agree with, you're not going to be allowed to issue a new reg until you get rid of two old ones, all right? And you're not going to be allowed to add to the financial regulatory burden with a new reg until you get rid of some of the old financial burden of the old regs. So we have sort of a regulatory two-in, one-out, and a regulatory net neutrality, not net neutrality, goodness gracious, revenue neutrality when it comes to the financial impact. I've seen a bunch of different numbers, and I can't remember if it was you folks or Heritage, it may have been you folks, if Andy's here, he would know this, that said that we had already lowered the annual regulatory burden in the country by $86 billion a year. We've been able to do that mostly by undoing mostly by undoing what the president, what the previous administration had done. People ask me all the time, "Oh, you guys haven't done that very much. You know, you guys have not had that much to claim to claim success for in the first 100 days." Go down the list of what we've done. Okay, everything that we could pretty much do by ourselves. I don't think anybody could say, you know what, the executive orders haven't been any good. The regulatory rollback hasn't been any good. The stuff that we've been able to do without Congress has been fantastic. When you look at Congress, yes, everybody draws attention to the fact the healthcare bill didn't pass until after the first 100 days. But I think we've passed now 14 Congressional Review Act pieces of legislation. I think previously it was used once. And so there's a legislative victory or a series of them over the course of the first 120 days now. What's the consistent theme there? Regulatory relief. Okay? No one expected us to get tax bill in the first 100 days. I don't think anybody really expected us to get healthcare finished during the first 100 days. It would have been nice to have the House pass it. But when you look at that first 120 days, so much of what we've been able to do is focused on that regulatory reform, and I think that speaks to what the president wants to do, and I'm glad that OIRA has been able to be involved with that. Yes, sir.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you about the Paperwork Reduction Act, which the OMB is charged with enforcing.
Yes.
The theory behind the Paperwork Reduction Act is that it's supposed to sort of act as a shield for private citizens and protect them from unnecessary information collection by government agencies. I wanted to ask, in your experience as a practical matter, does it actually constrain information collection by federal agencies? And if so, how? If not, what's the potential for it to be used to do that in the future?
Yeah, keep in mind, it's not just protecting individuals. It's protecting other branches of government and other agencies within the executive branch. I'm bound by it. You know, I mean, I can't send over some stuff that would violate the Paperwork Reduction Act and tell DOD to send me a mountain of documents. There's certain exceptions to that where we can at OMB, but it's actually one of those things that becomes sort of pervasive because everybody knows it's there. And that's the real answer to your question. Does it help? Yes. Because all the agencies know, well, wait a second, now if I do this and I have to make people do that, is that going to violate the Paperwork Reduction Act? So it sort of hangs over those agencies and colors their decision making. I think we're all probably not entirely satisfied with the outcome and still think we can do a better job of reducing the paperwork burden of the citizenry, and that it could be a better enforcement, that maybe the previous administration didn't push it as far as we might choose to in this administration. But I think generally speaking, it's pushing things in the right direction. This isn't your question, but since you raised that topic, you probably like this. One of the things we're working on right now within OMB is we have a list of things we want to do, which is always nice when you're in government, and we have a top 10 list of things we'd like to achieve this year. And one of them is we're identifying, let's see if I can articulate this correctly, lists of reports that OMB is statutorily required to produce. Okay, so by law, we must do them, that nobody has asked to see in the last 10 years. Okay? It's frightening how long the list is. It's not done yet, but that's one of the things we're focusing on at OMB this year to try and not only reduce paperwork burdens on the citizens, but also reduce paperwork on us because y'all pay us to generate those reports that nobody cares about. So anyway, yes, sir.
Yes, I just want to say that I think this has been, I'd like to congratulate you for probably the best 100 days of regulatory reform since President Reagan. And it's really extraordinary.
I can't take the credit for that, but thank you.
What you guys have been able to accomplish. And I know you personally were a champion of the RAINS Act when you were in Congress. And a lot of people are asking, well, what is the permanent legacy going to be of the Trump administration? And as you know, we've had a lot of trouble getting the RAINS Act through the Senate. But the other problem is that because it's a $100 million threshold, it doesn't protect religious liberty, doesn't protect Second Amendment rights, and creative bureaucrats in a future administration could do multiple regulations which have a lower impact and thus evade than $100 million and evade the RAINS Act. So there's now language in the Republican platform, a unanimous endorsement of the Republican National Committee. 1,000 state legislators and 7 governors and former governors, Mike Pence was the first governor, who support a constitutional version of the RAINS Act called the Regulation Freedom Amendment, which puts Congress in charge of deciding what's a major regulation and says regulations have to be approved by Congress. And with 33 states now that have Republican majorities in the legislature, and the public that's just outraged at the abuses of regulators in the last administration, maybe we could do what states did when they persuaded Congress to propose the Bill of Rights, and more recently presidential term limits, and force Congress with state pressure to propose a constitutional solution that would be a generational, would last for a generation. And in fact, 25 state legislative chambers have now passed resolutions urging Congress to propose the Regulation Freedom Amendment. You're doing the transformation of the executive branch. Have you thought about doing something constitutional or recommending that to the president so that we can be free of the fear of regulators, not just for his term, but permanently?
That raises about 17 different issues, all of which are really, really good. Let me deal with a couple of them in turn. Because you said something early that struck me, which is going to probably appeal more to David than say that David's group than this group, but I think this group can probably get behind it. What's the permanent legacy of this administration? When we are done, what will we look back at and say, that's what we did? And this is not the question you asked, but it's the answer I'm going to give you because it's the answer to your question. 3% sustained economic growth in this country. I tell people all the time that we have forgotten what it's like to live and work in a healthy American economy. If you're here today and you're 30 years old or younger, you really have never worked in a thriving U.S. economy. You've either been through recession or sluggish recovery, and that's it. And I'm here to tell you, as somebody who's old enough to remember a healthy American economy, it is night and day different. I remember what it was like in the 1990s when I quit my job to go start my own company because you had the type of confidence that you knew you could do that because the economy would support it. If you got fired, you could go find another job because the economy would support it. And just imagine the freedom that that gives you, the freedom it gives to entrepreneurs, the new business startups. One of the things we've seen drop off dramatically as we've sort of fallen into this, almost into this rut of thinking that 1.9% growth is the new normal. And everything that we are doing is aimed at that. In fact, I read the Economist magazine this weekend and I thought it was a complete hatchet job on the president. And I'm trying to figure out a way to put succinctly what Trumponomics is, and the top line is 3% sustained economic growth. Keeping in mind, by the way, and I'll put my budget hat back on for a second, you have to make a couple of assumptions to do this, but if we had a longer time, I could explain this. But I'm comfortable saying this, is that if we had had 3% economic growth for every year since the last recession, the budget would be balanced this year. That's the difference between what we've had for the last decade and what we could have had for the last decade and should have for the next decades to come. 3% growth is what this country is built on, and it's one of those things that makes America great. Now, to your point about the RAINS Act, yes, we'd love to see it passed. In fact, we're trying to figure out a way to strategically how would we push that, because that is a big part of the president's agenda. We talk about things about debt ceilings and funding bills in September, so there's different ways to take a look at it. We're trying to figure out if it's reconcilable or not for the budget process. We think it probably is, but we're not sure. I can tell you this, is that de facto it's already the law. And the folks who are running the agencies know that we're not going to do those without having congressional input. So the problem, of course, is that that's not permanent. And that gets to your last point, or one of your last points. And I don't know. We've not looked at a convention of the states. I think if we have, at least if I have personally, I'm more familiar with it in terms of the balanced budget amendment and the term limits agenda. I'm not familiar with RAINS.
This is not about a convention, though. This is about just the states persuading Congress
And states could persuade to do it. And one of the ways states could lever is if you do get close to having enough states to do it. I've heard that argument before, and I think it's probably accurate. Look, we are interested in long-term regulatory reform in this country because the president knows what it does to the economic spirit. And we'll do whatever we can legally to fix that. Thanks. Yes, sir.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned the RAINS Act, having been a senior attorney in two offices of general counsel. I mean, my critique with the RAINS Act is that you can have three guys in the various bureaus, agencies, and going, all right, every rule is $99 million and 99 cents, and then the end of the next Democrat administration, because we've never passed a major rule. And then going through the courts, you have the Chevron. I am now firmly convinced that this
true, but I'll cut you off right there. I'll let you ask your question, but keep in mind that don't you think if they really abused that, if it was really going to be $500 billion and they got it down to that 99.9, that it would open them up to litigation, which might allow you to delay the implementation of that rule. But go ahead.
And my response is policy is personnel, which is why we have President Trump.
Agreed.
But the answer, I am now firmly convinced that the solution really is it's a budgetary issue. And you're talking about this notion of what is President Trump's legacy with growing. And he's talked about reducing waste, fraud, and abuse. What your administration is not doing is conveying a very good story. In 2011, we did a major study. In fact, David was there at the rollout, and we just did an update in January. It turns out that if you can do a 10% cut of across the board regulatory budget, 10% cut, you pick up $1.2 trillion in GDP and 3 million more jobs. And in fact, each federal regulator—
10% cut in spending or 10% cut in the regulatory budget?
The regulatory budget. The regulatory budget across the board,
right. Yeah, okay.
You pick that up. And in fact, you can actually calculate it as a cost per regulator, 138 private sector jobs per regulator. And I think if you explain it that way, you've got your budget cuts, because surely you can find 10% of fat in any agency. And I've got a copy of the study if you want. But I think you guys have got to work on your messaging, because I know you're trying to cut the budget. And that's a more effective. And the idea is obviously you're not getting the argument over what's better regulation, but surely with less resources, you will be more judicious in your regulatory interventions. So there you go.
I think that's fair. I think we may agree with you more than you realize. Again, I'm not at liberty now to sort of unveil different pieces and parts of the budget, but next week, when you see our economic projections, you may hear some discussion about what's underlying those economic projections and how do we arrive at certain levels of growth that we assume for our budget and how we defend them. And it would surprise me if you don't hear something about regulatory reform at the agencies and writ large as part of that discussion.
All right, well, just trying to be helpful.
Thank you. We need all the help we can get. Oh, by the way, on the spending, I've said this before, and I guess I haven't gotten in trouble for it yet, so I'll say it again. I do wonder really seriously, people say, well, you know, if you don't get 3% growth, can you balance the budget? And I struggle with that. I don't know if the country is ready to balance the budget based just upon reducing spending. And keep in mind what you'd have to do. It'd be a 12 or 13%, I think, across the board cut this year to balance the budget. I think we've trained people to be immune to the true costs of government. People think government is cheaper than it is because we've allowed ourselves to borrow money for a long period of time and not have to worry about paying it back. So, I mean, if you got to use your credit card and didn't have to pay it back, you might feel like life was a lot better than it really is. And I've often believed that people are not willing to pay for the government they're getting, which is one of the reasons I support a what they call a jump ball balance budget, because folks would never tolerate the tax increases necessary to balance the budget. But I wonder if you could do it just on spending, and I think you'll see that relayed in our, I think what we're trying to get at is the way we balanced the budget in the 90s was we had spending restraint and GDP growth caught up and government revenues caught up as the GDP growth came in. I think that's what we're trying to get back to. That wasn't really the answer, I'm sorry, but yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Neve Ellis. I'm a reporter at The Hill.
Just
on that last point, that said, do you plan any new revenues in this budget? And also, in this two-for-one regulations thing, what are the parameters of that? Is that number of rules? Is it pages of rules? Is it value of rules? Is it number of steps? What does two-for-one mean?
Well, I'll go to the second one first because it's both. It's number of rules, and then you also layer on top of that regulatory budget we talked about, which is you're going to add a dollar, you got to take a dollar out. So the two sort of work together. As to the first one, I'm more than happy to talk to you about what the budget will have in it next week when we actually roll the budget out. You didn't really think I was going to tell you the answer.
It was worth a shot.
Let's yes, do sir. One or two more.
Hi, my name is Sean Callahan. Thanks for coming.
Hey, Sean.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the CR. So it included a lot of money for defense, the OCO money, which was a priority of the president's, but it also seemed to be a success for the president in that the negotiation process, listening to your press conference, it sounded like the negotiations process that yielded that CR was remarkably functional and open across the aisle. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about how that worked and just the CR in general and what that portends for the future.
It's a really, really good question. It's a little bit down in the weeds, but this seems like that kind of group. The president did, we were very pleased with the results of the CR. I know we took originally some, it was very interesting, by the way. the media reports for the first 24 hours were how the Democrats handed us our hats in the negotiation. And then I went and did a press conference for 45 minutes and showed everybody how well we did, and then all the story stopped. I guess that means we won, because they were never going to print that we won, so they just stopped talking about how we lost. I think the real big gain there, though, in addition to the money we got for the president's priorities, you know, money for defense, money for border security, money for school choice, and then that intangible of not shutting the government down, keeping in mind there were a lot of people who thought that's exactly what was going to happen. In fact, there was a lot of people in the other party who really wanted that to happen because they loved the narrative to be Trump can't govern. So the fact that we were able to get our priorities funded and not shut the government down, we took as a dramatic success. Did we have to give the Democrats stuff? Yeah, absolutely, because that's the way the Senate works. And if you have to have 60 votes, that means you have to have 8 Democrats, and they're going to want something in return for their votes, and that's what we gave them. But I think in the grand scheme of things, even in just the immediate measures, we did really, really well. But longer term, what we did was we broke that dollar-for-dollar parity that existed under Barack Obama, where when we wanted something, which is typically but not always defense, when the Republicans wanted something, they had to give the Democrats a dollar worth of something that they wanted. And we got that down to 20 cents, which any way you slice it is a much better deal than the previous administration would have gotten. So we were very, very pleased with that, and I hope it bears fruit for the 18 funding as well. Yes, sir.
Hi,
I have no idea what time it is, so I'll do this one.
It's past your time, so...
Okay, we'll take one more, and then we'll...
Yeah.
So, sorry about that. Yes, sir.
Okay.
I started over here, so I'll finish it with
okay, you. I'll be quick. My name is Jim Calderwood. My question is...
You guys are the problem. I'm the problem. I told you.
Your two-for-one rule, is there any way you can make that apply to the independent regulatory agencies, the NLRB, the SEC, the FTC, CPSC, and all the other alphabet groups out there, realizing, of course, as you appoint people, the administration appoints people to run these agencies, they can extract pledges from them as to what they would do. But in the meantime, is there any way you can make that applicable to the independent agencies?
Yes and no.
That's a good answer.
Here's the detail to it. Let's take my favorite agency, for example, the Consumers Financial Protection Bureau.
Yes. Good one.
Yeah, not my favorite, by the way. There are things we can do. For example, when Mr. Cordray's term is up in July of next year, we could appoint somebody who would actually run it in a meaningful way, or perhaps not even open the doors at all. That's a joke, by the way, for the press who are here. But only a little bit. So there are certain things, yes, we with our appointments, we can try and bring some of those independent agencies into the fold, so to speak. The problem, of course, with that is that it's only temporary, wouldn't follow through to the next administration that doesn't see life like that. That being said, I heard today for the first time that the Obama administration had actually asked a couple of their independent agencies to start acting like they were part of the executive branch. Not sure how they got there. Would you hear the same thing on that?
Yeah.
Not sure how far they got with that. But I think at the end of the day, the argument is extraordinarily sound to bring all of them under, in my case, OIRA, but all of them under the executive branch. I think we could have a longer discussion about whether or not the Federal Reserve, because of its very, very unique function, falls into that. So let's take that out of the discussion for right now, but let's talk about the CFPB, you talk about the NLRB, and say, look, if they aren't where we want them to be, if they're not in the executive branch and subject to oversight by us, in addition to oversight by Congress, in the case of the CFPB, not even subject to congressional appropriations, where's the accountability? How do you stop a runaway organization, which I would contend to you is what you saw in the CFPB under the previous administration. It doesn't make any sense to people, even folks on the other side of the aisle, to say, I want to create an agency and you're not going to have any say over it whatsoever. Because that's really, really dangerous. And towards the end of the Obama administration, we started to have some of our Democrat friends in the Financial Services Committee come over to us and start talking about reforming the CFPB because they realized exactly what all smart Democrats should have started realizing towards the end of that, which is that they could lose. And a CFPB run by the Trump administration would look very different from the CFPB under a Clinton administration. If they always thought they were going to be in charge, then they don't care, right, because they get their way. But they started to realize how a Republican-driven CFPB could do things very, very differently. And I thought maybe they think several of them wanted to sort of bring the CFPB into a more reasoned light, talk about adding a five-person board instead of the one-person director, putting them on congressional appropriations, and so forth. So we didn't get there in the last administration. I hope that we do get here. The administration supports reforms of the CFPB. You will see the CFPB dealt with in the policies and the budget as we roll them out next week. And I think that's something that that can apply to many of the other agencies. I could do this all night, but I have to go home and read 4,000 pages worth of budget. And then I'm having dinner tonight with Steve Moore. You know Steve Moore.
I do know.
So Steve calls me last week and says, would you like to have dinner on Wednesday night with me and a couple of my friends? And I'm like, no, but I'll go, because I need to eat. I've lost 12 pounds since I got this job, and I just forget to eat. And I'm like, okay, that's great. I'll be in the middle of budget week, so I'll go and have dinner with Steve and a couple other guys, and then we'll go back and go to budget. I'm the keynote speaker tonight to 600 people.
Yeah.
So, yeah, exactly. So I'm going to go home and figure out now, go back to the office, figure out what I'm going to say tonight. So thank you all very much for having me. Thanks to the Federalist Society. Thanks.